the distinguished speaker.
It's our great pleasure to welcome back Dr. John Wilson for our April series of seminars. John is a former professor of church history at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary and a part of the Westminster Church family. Over decades, John has given many seminars at Westminster. They have all been rich in content, clearly presented with deep insight and a wry sense of humor. The fascinating topic of Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich is one we've looked forward to for a long time. We have much to learn, so let's get started. John?
Okay. Ted, could you clear the screen just a little bit more? I'm not seeing the entire prayer, and I'm not sure what that last word is in the... Okay, I think I know what it is.
And John, I'll just note that if your thumbnail picture of yourself is covering up that prayer, everybody can move the thumbnail on their screen themselves. That's not determined by me, but it's determined by whoever. And so I just advise everybody to keep the thumbnail up in the upper right-hand corner, because that's always clear on these slides.
Okay, that's good.
I see the whole thing, just FYI.
We've got it. Okay. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Lord, with grateful thanks for a new day, for the life it gives, and for its possibilities. For all these things, we give you grateful thanks. We pray with Reinhold Niebuhr's famous prayer, God, give me the grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. In Christ's name, amen. While we're staying with this screen, you see the Time magazine cover. It's 1948, as Man of the Year, or as, yes, very prominent. It's in this period of time that he is being considered, even as a possible presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, and then also as possible Secretary of State. Had Adlai Stevenson been elected. So an indication of Niebuhr's prominence. If you can scroll down a bit, Ted, to the publications. These are his major publications. And the ones I'm going to be citing today, reading from, are all currently available through Amazon as new publications. It's remarkable that so many of his works are so current that they're being published today. And then on Niebuhr, the most important biographical piece is Richard Fox, Reinhold Niebuhr, a biography, also republished, available today. And then Ronald Stone, Niebuhr in the 1960s, and this book, Christian Realism in a Secular Age, that's a collection of Niebuhr's shorter writings. I should say about 1950, Niebuhr has a stroke, and this pretty much stops his literary work, except for shorter works, shorter essays and so forth. And he's in a very definite physical, a period of physical problems, mental and physical, often depressed. So it's quite a serious stroke, although it's not debilitating and it doesn't paralyze him, it has great effect. So he doesn't really do anything major and until certainly in the 1960s and after Martin Luther King. Now, this is part of his personal story that I'm going to pick up a little further. He is the, you want to go back to the picture page. He's the son of German immigrants. His father is a pastor. They're first located in Missouri and then relocated to a church in Illinois. His father is quite conservative. The church is interesting. It's a very small denomination in Germany already, and certainly also in America, that combines Calvinism and Lutheranism. That's one of the reasons why it stayed small, because the Lutheran theologians reacted so strongly against the union, mainly on the basis of the question of communion, the communion elements, different interpretation, but that's another story. Reinhold Niebuhr goes to a small denominational school. And from there, he goes to Yale. And it's kind of unusual that anyone would go from a small denominational school to Yale. And the reason is he had an advocate from his own small church at Yale. And he's recognized as a very talented student, goes to Yale. He will, in the 1920s, become pastor of Bethel Church in Detroit. Often this is portrayed as some sort of work in difficult areas, slum areas, or poor areas. It was not. It was on the rather edge of the city, toward the west. And if you know Detroit, you know the suburbs grow out in that direction, very wealthy ones. And his church grew under his pastorate and slowly became rather upper class, more and more educated, and rather more wealthy people entered the church. Soon, however, he gets his pursuits have very much to do with the labor problem in industry. Now, it helps a great deal to know the history of this period. The influx of immigrants, the way immigrant labor was exploited, the riots that went with it, right on into the 20th century, and certainly also in Pittsburgh. And he's very, very aware of this. And in Detroit, he's very focused on Henry Ford and the Ford Works and problems of labor. I'm not going to go into that, just to say this is context in which he begins to work. And he gains reputation and recognition by writing articles, first in newspapers. He starts getting attention, first letters to editor, then articles submitted. And he begins to get attention for this. Now, also as a Yale graduate, he gets attention. And slowly this develops. So he gets his reputation not so much by a new book, not actually by being a great academic, but writing all of these articles and getting more and more recognition. And he will be invited and will accept a position at Union Theological Seminary. He never actually gets a doctorate. But he doesn't really need it. He's in the situation where he's getting recognition very rapidly and at Union. Now, very early on at Union, they want him back at Yale because of the kind of reputation he's developing. He's now published a first book, which today is not all that much recognized as a great piece of work, but it certainly has gotten him attention and it's gotten him academic recognition. But he stays at Union and he will remain at Union. Now, Ted, if we could go to the first slide, Moral Man and Immoral Society. This is his first big book and it still is today. And I want to focus as much as possible on texts. Through this. So reading texts, trying to digest them, and certainly also if you have questions or comments, to give you time for those, but we have a good many texts to get through. I've tried to be representative. I'm going to add to them here and there from readings from these books. But you see, Moral Man, Immoral Society, 1932. Right. I'm going to read it and ask you to follow. Individual men may be moral in the sense that they are able to consider interests other than their own in determining problems of conduct and are capable on occasion of preferring the advantages of others to their own. Their rational faculty prompts them to a sense of justice, which educational discipline may refine and purge of egoistic elements until they are able to view a social situation in which their own interests are involved with a fair measure of objectivity. But all these achievements are more difficult, if not impossible, for human societies and social groups. In every human group, there is less reason to guide and to check impulse, less capacity for self-transcendence, less ability to comprehend the needs of others, and therefore more unrestrained egoism than the individuals who compose the group reveal in their personal relationships. Now that is from the introduction, and that is a very famous statement. It kind of states a thesis that Niebuhr is going to follow continually throughout his life. So it kind of sets the track, so to speak. Now, let me just add to this a reading from also from the introduction. I'm just going to add to it my reading for myself. It's not on your screen, will not be. But this elaborates a little bit about what he means. It may be possible to establish just relations between individuals within a group purely by moral and rational suasion and accommodation. In intergroup relations, this is practically an impossibility. The relations between groups must therefore always be predominantly political rather than ethical. That is, they will be determined by the proportion of power which each group possesses, at least as much as by any rational and moral appraisal of the comparative needs and claims of each group. Now that elaborates very well what he means, the problems of power in groups. Again, this is very characteristic of what Niebuhr is concerned about. And just to add something again from this work, he quotes two kinds of liberals that he criticizes. One is William Adams Brown, a professor at Union. Kind of by the time Niebuhr is working on this book, I think William Adams Brown is retired. But what Brown writes about is the ideal of the League of Nations, and that this is having a great effect of idealism on the morals across the world. So he writes, for example, William Adams Brown, the relations between races and strife between capital and labor in our attitudes towards the weaker and more dependent members of society, we are developing a social conscience and situations which would have been accepted a generation ago as a matter of course are felt as an intolerable scandal. Now, Niebuhr calls that naive because it's not taking the realities of power situations into consideration. And then he also quotes another kind of liberal. This is a pastor, man by the name of Nixon, and all this is, in, by the way, in the introduction to Moral Man and Immoral Society. But Nixon writes this: another reason for believing in the growth of social statesmanship on the part of business leaders is based on their experience as trustees in various philanthropic and educational enterprises. And Niebuhr writes, "His judgment reveals the moral confusion of liberal Christianity with perfect clarity. Teachers of morals who do not see the difference between the problem of charity within the limits of an accepted social system and the problem of justice between economic groups holding uneven power within modern industrial society have simply not faced the most obvious differences between the morals of groups and the morals of individuals." So you see again the kinds of emphasis that Niebuhr places, and it's throughout the book, and it is very characteristic of his entire work. Now, if we could go to the next one. Right, this is also from the introduction. It's very interesting the way he focuses. Insofar as this treatise has polemic interest, it's directed against the moralists, both religious and secular, who imagine that the egoism of individuals is being progressively checked by the development of rationality or the group or the growth of religiously inspired goodwill, and that nothing but the continuance of this process is necessary to establish social harmony between all the human societies and collectives. So again, it's the same emphasis. But it's interesting that the critique is directed against moralists, religious and secular. And he will comment also on this. I should just like to add it. He will say it has a great deal to do with our society's belief in reason and what reason can do, whether it's religious or secular. There's a kind of moral interest in what reason is able to do. And again, Niebuhr's going to point to the problem of power. All right, if we go to the next one. Yes, number two. All right, he writes a great deal about the problem of race and the problem of Negroes in America. And here we have a typical statement: the emancipation of the Negro race in America probably waits on the adequate development of this kind of social and political strategy, that is, nonviolence. It is hopeless for the Negro to expect complete emancipation from the menial social and economic position into which the white man has forced him merely by trusting in the moral sense of the white race. The white race in America will not admit the Negro to equal rights if it is not forced to do so. Upon that point, one may speak with a dogmatism which all history justifies. Now, I add to that that Niebuhr writes a good bit on this problem, especially toward the end of the book, and what he holds up as nonviolence and where he's getting his theory of nonviolence is Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. And there's a good bit there on it. And he is definitely an advocate of nonviolence, although he doesn't entirely exclude some possibility of violence in this book. Clearly, he says, for example, that if African Americans were to rise up in violence, it would be totally catastrophic. So that this is nonviolence, but also political pressure. And that's very important, political pressure to move things toward reform. All right, if we could go to the next one. Three. Foundation of Christian Ethics, 1935. Now, one of the things Niebuhr was criticized for in that first book was so little attention to the church or to actual Christian doctrine, and he's changed that. Interpretation of Christian Ethics. This is one of his characteristic statements. By the way, it's a very readable book. I think it's the easiest one to read and the quickest one to read among all of his books. Very lucid. And the struggle between rich and poor, certain moral judgments are possible. They stand under criterion of the simplest of all moral principles, that of equal justice. That principle has been valid in all the advances made by human society, and its application to the modern social situation is obviously valid. Very characteristic of everything he writes. Let's go to the next slide, 4. The very essence of politics is the achievement of justice through equilibria of power. We're still in the same book. A balance of power is not conflict, but a tension between opposing forces underlies it. Where there is tension, there is potential conflict. And where there is conflict, there is potential violence. A responsible relationship to the political order, therefore, makes an unqualified disavowal of violence impossible. There may always be crises in which the cause of justice will have to be defended against those who will attempt its violent destruction. Now, what he's very aware of, and certainly also as a German American, is an American of German heritage, is what's happening in Europe and the rise of Hitler. And he's quite keenly aware of the problems that are coming up with fascism. And it's very unjust and demonic and criminal aspects. Let's go to the next one, 5. Now, this is one of his favorite targets, Dewey. And I don't know if you know John Dewey's Common Faith. I remember some time ago picking it up and reading it. I think I had it required for some course. Very, very interesting book. And Dewey was of great influence at one time. And I think recently I have seen his book again complimented as being an important contribution to current social conflicts. But just reading the comment, John Dewey in his book Common Faith would eliminate conflict and unite men of goodwill everywhere by stripping their spiritual life of historic, traditional, and supposedly anachronistic accretions. This proposal is a striking example of the faith of modern rationalism in the ability of reason to transcend the partial perspectives of the natural world in which reason is rooted. Now, partial perspectives, that is something that recurs in his writing right on to the end. Partial perspectives means the particularities in human communities. Ethnic, cultural, things that people identify with and are far more important for people than moral rationalists or rationalist moralists really comprehend. So stripping everything, taking away the historic, traditional, supposedly anachronistic accretions, all of these things, taking them off, just stripping them away where we have pure rational consideration by people of goodwill will lead to solutions of problems. And Niebuhr says that is realistically not the case. And one of the things he will say, for example, I think very current, take account of particular hopes and fears of people, things that determine behavior that aren't taken into consideration by this common rationalism represented by Dewey. Let's go to the number 6. A very interesting comment here. Again, in the same book, there's no deeper pathos in the spiritual life of man than the cruelty of righteous people. If any one idea dominates the teachings of Jesus, it is his opposition to the self-righteousness of the righteous. And he's talking certainly about the Pharisees. Now, this is, shows the new emphasis of the of this book over against moral man and moral society, the attention to Christian tradition specifically and to Jesus. And this will be a characteristic of his later work, more well-known work, Nature and Destiny of Man. And let's go to that one, Nature and Destiny of Man, number 7. Okay, Nature and Destiny of Man, 1941, 1943. We're in the middle of the war. He's quite aware, very much aware of what's happening in Europe, fascism, and He also shows in this book that there is pretty much confidence that Nazism is going to be defeated. He's not at all pessimistic here about losing the war. You don't see that in the book. All right, that's this one. I should say again, talk about his development of his Christian thought. He was criticized also in the books of the 1930s for not being Christian enough. That is, it doesn't talk about the church. And also in this book, Nature and Destiny of Man, he doesn't really talk about the church. We don't have a doctrine of the church, and he will be criticized for that. But that's not his interest. That's not his focus. His focus is always on ethics, Christian ethics, and the problems of the world in which Christian ethics has to be carried out. All right, again, very familiar theme, number 7. Maybe that the collective egotism of group pride represents a particular temptation to individuals who suffer from specific forms of the sense of inferiority. Now, here again, the sense of particularity, coming back to the particular situation, what people are actually like in their own situations with their own problems and sense, right here, sense of inferiority. The relation of modern fascist nationalism to the insecurity and sense of inferiority of the lower middle classes is therefore significant. Let me pause here and say, we know in fact that one of the great appeals of Nazism in Germany was definitely to the lower middle class. Although the upper class gets rewarded, the industrialists and so forth get rewarded for participating, it's definitely the popularity in the lower middle classes that's significant for the power of Nazism. And then continuing, collective pride is thus man's last and in some respects most pathetic effort to deny the determinate and contingent character of his existence. The very essence of human sin is in it. It can hardly be surprising that this form of human sin is also most fruitful of human guilt, that is, of objective social and historical evil. And then guilt is the objective consequence of sin, the actual corruption of the plan of creation and providence in the historical world. Let's go to 8. All right, these are again selections, hopping around different places in the book, in the two volumes. The anti-aristocratic emphasis of the Bible in Old and New Testament prophecies against the guilt of wealth and power has been interpreted by certain types of sectarian Christianity and by modern secular radicalism in two simple political moral terms. Jesus is reduced to the stature of a leader of a proletarian revolt against the rich. The same emphasis has, on the other hand, been too simply obscured by most types of conventional Christianity, which regards the humility of spirit, which Jesus extolled as a spiritual guide, again, obscured by this emphasis on humility. Biblical religion is too concerned with the ultimate and perennial human situation to permit a simple political interpretation of its anti-aristocratic tendencies. It is, on the other hand, too realistic to obscure the fact that socioeconomic conditions actually determine, to a large degree, that some men are tempted to pride and prejudice, while others are encouraged to be humble, to humility. I think that's a very insightful statement, as indeed Niebuhr is continually through this book. And number 9, the fact that according to the Bible, men of intellectual, spiritual, and moral eminence should fall under the same judgment as men of power will seem particularly offensive to most moralists. Now let's think of some great leaders. It is at this point that the anti-aristocratic tendencies of biblical religion stand in sharpest contrast to all forms of rationalism, which assume that the intelligent man is also the good man. Without understanding the sinfulness of the human heart in general, it is not possible to penetrate through the illusions and pretensions of the successful classes in every age. There again, I think quite insightful statements about situations that are also situations today. Let's go to 10. The greatest sin of moralistic Christianity is its tendency to encourage the assumption that men are as good as the ideals of justice and love which they entertain. Now there again, you know, you have to think about that. And you have to think about it also in terms of the kinds of analysis of society and of reasoning that Niebuhr is, in his penetrating way, is kind of discovering or uncovering for the reader. Ted, would it be possible to jump to 25 and then to go back again? Okay, now this connects with what we had before. This is 1957, so quite late. Billy Graham's simple vision of the Christian faith is very ironic. It cuts through all the hard antinomies of life and history, that is the contradictions and so forth of life and history, by the simple promise that really good people will be really good. And I think that's very humorous. But I don't think you can understand it unless you kind of go back to what we have been reading about the difference between ideals and the lack of ideals. Ted, could we go to 23? Irony of American History, 1952, where in the work, Irony Meets the Difference Between Dominant Ideals and the Reality They Tend to Obscure. Now this book has a great deal to do with power, Russian power and American power. And the ideals that are spoken in defense of the power and the reality of what the power means. I mean, we're talking about the destruction of the world, possible destruction of everything by bombs. He's acutely aware of that, highly aware of that. And he will reflect on the way power will speak in terms of ideals, great ideals. And yet this enormous destructive power. So I have a quotation: any modern community which establishes a tolerable justice is the beneficiary of the ironic triumph of the wisdom of common sense over the foolishness of its wise men. For the wise men are inevitably tempted to follow either one or the other line of rational advance, of which the bourgeois, that is favoring capitalist individualism, and the Marxist ideologies are perfect types. Again, the irony of the ideals and the reality of power and so forth, these kinds of relationships. And we get into that further. Let's go back. We go to 11. Ted. All structures of justice presuppose the sinfulness of man. This is again in Nature and Destiny of Man, Volume 2. All structures of justice presuppose the sinfulness of man and are all partially systems of restraint, which prevent the conflict of wills and interests from resulting in a consistent anarchy. But there are also mechanisms by which men fulfill their obligations to their fellow men. The kingdom of God and the demands of perfect love are therefore relevant to every political system and impinge upon every social situation in which the self seeks to come to terms with the claims of other life. I'm going to go to the next one, number 12. Now this is from one of the last chapters, I think it's chapter 9 in Nature and Destiny of Man, has been recognized as a highly important chapter in understanding Niebuhr, just to point that out. But this is a characteristic quotation from this chapter. Systems and principles of justice are the servants and instruments of the spirit of brotherhood. Insofar as they extend the sense of obligation towards the other A, from an immediately felt obligation promoted by obvious need, to a continued obligation expressed in fixed principles of mutual support. And B, from a simple relationship between a self and the other, to the complex relations of the self and the others. And C, finally, from the obligations discerned by the individual to the wider obligations which the community defines from its more impartial perspective. These communal definitions evolve slowly in custom and law. In these three ways, rules and laws of justice stand in a positive relation to the law of love. And the capacity of communities to synthesize divergent approaches to a common problem and arrive at a tolerably just solution proves man's capacity to consider interests other than his own. Now here, this is somewhat in contradiction to his earlier statements about groups being only egotistical. He modifies that. He says, yes, it's true, but democracy, especially the one when it works, demonstrates this kind of capacity. Let's go to 13. Very important theological statement. And I should say, I've divided Niebuhr into two groups. One is focused on his ethics, and the second, some theological aspects of his thought. Here we have them rather bound together. And it's very interesting comment. Again, in the nature and destiny of man. The final majesty, the ultimate freedom, and the perfect disinterestedness of the divine love can have a counterpart in history only in a life which ends tragically. Now, come back, the divine, the perfect disinterestedness, the love of God for all, can have a counterpart in history only in a life which ends tragically because it refuses to participate in the claims and counterclaims of historical existence. It portrays a love which seeks not its own, but a love that seeks not its own is not able to maintain itself in historical society. Not only may it fall victim to excessive forms of the self-assertion of others, but even the most perfectly balanced system of justice in history is a balance of competing wills and interests, and must therefore worst anyone who does not participate in the balance. In apprehending the cross as a symbol of this ultimate perfection, Christian faith has always been profounder than the theologies which sought to rationalize it. For faith has consistently regarded the cross as the point in history where the sinful rivalries of ego with ego are transcended. Let me comment on this, that there has been among ethicists disagreement that the practice of Christian love and its most serious form, it's in a form here where Niebuhr thinks it has to end in a catastrophe, so to speak, tragically. Let's say, no, here Niebuhr is wrong. We have to pursue it in a Christian way and aggressively in a Christian way. Of course, Niebuhr is saying that too. But he's saying that's not realistic in terms of really getting down to the nitty-gritty of power problems in specific situations. And there he says, let's add in different ways, the Christ, the love of Jesus, is really truly transcends history. It impinges, as he says earlier, the kingdom of God impinges on every possible social situation. But like the life of Christ ends tragically, so also must any similar kind of life with similar ideals, similar behavior end tragically. Now, this has been up for conversation among ethicists. Like I say, some disagree. Particularly there is a Mennonite theologian who certainly pursues the thought that perfect love has to be expressed politically, come what may. And again, is Niebuhr being too realistic? Is this effectively some sort of break? Niebuhrians, defenders of Niebuhr, think not. We're going to continue. Let's go to the next slide, 14. The good news of the gospel is that God takes the sinfulness, but continues, 13, excuse me. The good news of the gospel is that God takes the sinfulness of man into himself, overcomes it in his own heart, what cannot be overcome in human life, since human life remains within the vicious circle of sinful self-glorification on every level of human advance. And he says this is also true, certainly, of ethicists. This continuing problem of sin in human life and the subtlety of self-glorification or obviousness of self-glorification on every level of moral advance. Now, again, we could disagree with that or not, but that is Niebuhr's own conviction. Go to 14. The cross represents a perfection which contradicts the false pretensions of virtue in history and which reveals the contrast between man's sinful self-assertion and the divine agape, or the divine love. Let's go to 15. Now we go to another book, 1944, Children of Light and the Children of Darkness, a vindication of democracy and a critique of its traditional defense. Right, the Children of Light are moral thinkers and idealists, naive about the influence of self-interest. The evil Children of Darkness are wise in understanding the power of self-interest and know how to use it. Right, a quotation, modern Children of Light expect modern society to achieve an essential uniformity through the common convictions of men and goodwill. We've been enlightened by modern liberal education. This belief fails to appreciate the endless variety of cultural and religious convictions growing out of varying historical situations. The increase in the intensity and extent of social cohesion extends community, but it also aggravates social conflict. Now there again, you hear his common theme on the moralism of goodwill and so forth, and it's false. Let's go to the next one, 16. The Children of Light must be armed with the wisdom of the Children of Darkness, but remain free from their malice. They must know the power of self-interest in human society without giving it moral justification. They must have this wisdom in order that they may beguile, deflect, harness, and restrain self-interest, individual and collective, for the sake of the community. Now you see, that's where his ethics are touching on political policy. Again, a very interesting comment. Let's go to 17. The most effective opponents of tyrannical government are today, again, we still haven't defeated Nazism, but it looks pretty sure that Nazism is going to be defeated. Opponents of tyrannical government today, as they have been in the past, men who can say we must obey God rather than man. Their resolution is possible because they have a vantage point from which they can discount the pretensions of demonic Caesars and from which they can defy malignant power as embodied in a given government. 18. The first religious apprehension of a universal and unlimited moral obligation was achieved in prophetic monotheism, which had its inception in the prophet Amos's conception of a universal history over which the God of Israel presided as sovereign, but of which the history of Israel was not the center and end. Now, I selected this out because already in earlier works, especially in Nature and Destiny of Man, and then continuingly, he will lift up the prophets. Amos, Isaiah, and this very strong emphasis on Amos as the one whose vision, so to speak, dominates even what comes in Isaiah. Something that it's characteristic of Niebuhr's later work, and very important to recognize it, the significance of Amos and the prophets of Israel. Let's go to 19. Particularly insightful. The Nazi effort was profound in the sense that the perils of liberty are sufficient to have made it practically inevitable. That some community would try to avoid them in the manner of Nazism. The fact that tribal primitivism results in the perversity, and that coerced unity produces sadistic cruelties is a tremendously valuable lesson for our civilization. One of the greatest problems of democratic civilization is how to integrate the life of its various subordinate ethnic, religious, and economic groups in such a way that the richness and harmony of the whole community will be enhanced and not destroyed. In many ways, that sounds very contemporary. Let's go to 20. Once it is fully understood that advancing civilization tends to accentuate rather than diminish such disproportions of power as he has just described, it must become apparent that property rights become instruments of injustice. In that sense, the Marxist interpretation of the effect of property in history is correct. Let's go to 21. Marxist theory fails to anticipate the inevitable rise of an oligarchy in a new society. Even if a community approached the socialization of property by gradual stages and circumvented the period of revolution and dictatorship, it would still face the question of how to socialize property without creating pools of excessive social power in the hands of those who manage both its economic and its political processes. Now, just pause to comment. I think history has shown us very clearly that that was true in the history of the Soviet Union and of Maoist China, and continues to be characteristic of any communist society. Continuing the reading, the contrasting perils of anarchy and injustice arising from too little and too much equilibrium of economic power, or from too much or too little social control over it, must be considered in the light of each new situation and technical development. The property issue must, in other words, be continually solved within the framework of the democratic process. It is valuable to remember that some forms of property are by their very nature power over others, while other types are primarily to secure the person against the aggrandizement of others or against the caprice of life and nature. And again, others represent primarily the power to perform one's social function. Let's go to 22. Dead to 22. All right, very famous statement, often quoted. Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. And man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. And then the second one, democracy is a method for finding proximate solutions to insoluble problems. I think that is very ironic and humorous and corresponds in many ways to our experience. Let's go to the next one, 23. We've already had that one to 24. Now this is 1957. It's from an article by Niebuhr called Theology of Political Thought in the Western World. And it's often cited as a summary of his method, of Niebuhr's method. Self-criticism, critical thinking, political realism, skepticism, theological realism's hope. These resources give us some treasures to contribute to the community in its struggle for justice. Among them are also an understanding of the fragmentary character of all human virtue, the tentative character of all schemes of justice, since they are subject to the flow of history, the irrevocable character of the moral law, transcending all historical relativities, and hazardous judgments which must be made to establish justice between competing forces and interests. And with that, I am at the end of my ethical statement. Following this is a consideration of some notable aspects of Niebuhr's religious thought. But I'm going to pause here and ask Ted to open this for any comments or discussions. Ted, you might also remind us how much time we have. Okay.
So we officially go till 10:45, and I'll stop the recording at then, but people can pipe up with questions right now. And I'll start with one. I am struck by a sort of a theme throughout what you've talked about from Niebuhr about reason and rationalization. And I'm used to thinking of reason as being a good thing, but in the last few years, I've been thinking about rationalization as a very bad thing. And I'm just wondering if I'm just seeing that because I want to in what he's saying, or if indeed that's a point he's getting across.
No, I think that's right. I always have to consider he considers reason in ethics as under some sort of moral ideal. And he can say it can be a force for good, but it can also be a cover for realism. And moral idealists have a tendency to believe so much in moral reason that they don't take sufficient account of the actual realities that have to be dealt with. So in that sense, I would say it's yes, pro reason, and reason can be very problematic. Others can reflect on this too, that very question, not just me.
I have a comment or a question. I wish we had more time, but here's my problem. It seems like spirituality and politics are irreconcilable. And I'm kind of studying Gandhi, and in the beginning of his life, when he was trying to figure out what the heck to do, realized that he was very spiritual and also had a gift. He was very politically astute, and he thought he had to make a choice between the two. And then he had an insight that, why don't I join them as one force? And that became his dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A. That was the purpose of his life. And he actually became so powerful that he was almost able to unite the whole subcontinent of India against the British Empire, and had people weaving cloth with his chakra little weaving machines, and that had the power. If all the Indians, the Muslims and the Indians and the Christians and the other type united, sink the whole industry with their power, you know, this subtle, but it all the principle of nonviolence. The thing that strikes me about Gandhi is he read the Bible, the New Testament. He was blown away by the Sermon on the Mount, and he felt that that was the perfect statement of his Hinduism. And he had this incredible way of uniting, doing the principle of almost uniting the whole continent of India as one force. So here's my thought. How, you know, I'm a lawyer, a trial lawyer, and lawyers think that the law solves the problem. Any good trial lawyer knows that's nonsense. The law does not. So what would unite political purpose and spiritual in American society? No one has really come up with something that really unites them. So that's my question. How can they both be one force?
Well, what I would do is point back to some of those quotations where he's talking about the democracy bringing together different groups to achieve reconciliation or to achieve solution of problems, however imperfectly. And never is going to be any perfect situation because history moves. And he will comment on this. Any given solution may be valid today and wrong tomorrow. History continually moves, and that the ideal, he sincerely means this, and he says it in Nature and Destiny of Man. The ideal of perfect reconciliation is the kingdom of God, which impinges on history, but is not realized. And he believes that it's not realized. I'm going to get into some of that in the second section on Niebuhr when we talk about aspects of his religious thought, which we won't be getting to today, but I hope after Tillich is finished in the next two, to be able to come back to Niebuhr's religious thought and pick some of that up. But others want to comment on that.
I'm going to jump in and stop the recording, and then people can talk, continue to talk just as long as they want, and say thank you very much. This has been very, very interesting and really right relevant to our present times.